Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, President Trump exhorted Senate Republicans to keep at it.
Inaction is not an option. And frankly, I don't think we should leave town unless we have a health insurance plan.
But the prospects of passing a repeal and replace, or just a repeal, seem dim. It's a stunning turn of events for Republicans who control the White House and both houses of Congress. It casts serious doubts on their prospects to address other policy goals. And, of course, our hearts go out to Senator John McCain, diagnosed with brain cancer.
I had a chance to talk to his closest friend in the Senate, Senator Lindsey Graham, and Graham told me that he had just spoken to John McCain, spoken to some of his closest aides as well, and they are trying to figure out exactly what to do next.
Manu Raju, senior congressional reporter at CNN, joined me to talk about these and some of the other top stories of the week.
If you're looking to help people who aren't in care, one of the ways to do that is to go after a technology that's ubiquitous.
I also talked with Dr. Tom Insel, former head of the National Institute of Mental Health, about why he believes data from our smartphones may lead to more effective and timely treatments for mental health. Manu Raju, it's good to hear from you again.
Great to be here, Diane.
First, here's CNN's senior congressional reporter, Manu Raju. It's been another wild week in Washington, but first we ought to talk about Senator John McCain. I gather there is now a consideration of his medical options. And the question becomes whether he'll come back to the Senate. What do you think?
We really just don't know yet. I had a chance to talk to his closest friend in the Senate on Thursday morning. That's Senator Lindsey Graham. And Graham told me that he had just spoken to John McCain, spoken to some of his closest aides as well. And they are trying to figure out exactly what to do next. We know that this is probably going to be intense in terms of his medical options that he has to consider and go through. And he may not be back imminently. Of course, the Senate is going to recess in August before they head out, before they return in the second week of September. So the question is, can he come before the August recess? It's the question I posed to Lindsey Graham. And he said, we just don't know.
Sure.
McCain needs to get back and be in a quality shape, not come back prematurely. So they are taking it very deliberately. And I think he's going to deal with this very seriously, because this type of brain cancer that he has, Diane, is a similar one that Ted Kennedy had as well. And I remember those days. Kennedy was out for some time.
Yes.
Before he was able to return.
Yes.
To the Senate.
But here you've got health care, and the president is urging the Senate to do something, but there does not seem to be too many options.
There really aren't. The Republicans are just so badly divided over not just the policy, but also the strategy. The president himself has not helped things, because he continues to change his tactics, saying at one point earlier this week, we should just repeal Obamacare and then replace later, and then saying we should just let Obamacare collapse and then work with Democrats to pass a replacement, and then saying yesterday we should repeal and replace at the same time. As we know, the replacement plan has just prompted major divisions among Republicans, who just cannot agree on some of the fundamental aspects of their bill, whether it's cutting Medicaid, whether it's dealing with the expansion of Medicaid in those Medicaid states. The party is just, right now, the votes just are not there.
Of course, you've also got the Congressional Budget Office coming out with a statement about how many millions would lose care.
Yeah, no question about it. And that just did not help things. The Congressional Budget Office last week, earlier this week, put out a score saying that 32 million more people would be uninsured by 2026 if the repeal went into effect without a replacement. And we know that the replacement plan that passed the House does not do much better. Only roughly somewhere in the mid 20 million people or so by 2026 would also lose health insurance. So those headlines are very problematic. There are a number of Republicans who are concerned by just moving forward on a repeal plan because not that option shows that premiums would increase significantly if there is no replacement.
Exactly.
The party has not gone on the same page as replacement. And Diane, a new CNN ORC poll out Thursday morning shows that just 18% of the public supports repealing the law without a replacement.
Yeah.
So the Republicans are in a very difficult spot as they're heading to a crucial vote next week.
So, Manu, what does that mean as far as other items that need to be taken care of or that the president really wanted taken care of? For example, tax reform. The whole budget, the debt ceiling, how are we going to get to a place where we can bring Republicans and Democrats together on those issues?
Well, it's going to be very tough. Right now, we're seeing Republicans in the Senate and moving on their own, and Democrats not working with them. So it's the Republicans are going to have to try to move some of these pieces of legislation within their own party, get enough support. And right now, on some of those matters that you just mentioned, very difficult. So if the health care bill fails, that's going to be a big problem for moving tax reform, because some of the deficit savings they were going to try to use to pay for tax cuts. So that won't happen if the health care bill fails. On top of that, you have to pass in order to move this process through the Senate and avoid a filibuster. On tax reform, you have to actually pass a budget first. And right now, the Republicans are in major disagreement over exactly what the budget itself should say. So if they can't get the budget approved, then they can't get tax reform approved without significant Democratic support, and that's going to be difficult. I mean, tax reform requires is the entire economy, essentially, and while the health care is hard enough with that covers 1/6 of the economy.
Sure.
So this is they are running into a very difficult road, especially as we get closer to the midterm elections. It'll be more difficult to make decisions.
I am so interested in the fact that President Trump agreed to do the interview with what he called the failing New York Times. Why do you think he decided to do that?
It's a great question. You know, and he criticizes it as fake news, fake media, but he obviously realized that he needed to answer some questions. I mean, look, the president has just not answered questions from the media virtually at all. He's had, one news conference since winning, since becoming president, in full-fledged news conference. They take their press briefings off camera. Their spokespeople can't answer questions. He probably felt like he wanted to get his word out there on some of these key issues.
But some of those words may come back to haunt him. For example, what he said about the attorney general.
Yeah, no question about that. I mean, saying that the attorney general should not have recused himself from overseeing the Russia investigation, that he would not have selected him to be attorney general had he told him ahead of time that he would recuse himself. I spent the day asking Republicans on Capitol Hill about that, and they were alarmed by that, including some very influential members, including Orrin Hatch, the longest-serving Republican senator told me that those words, quote, would haunt President Trump, and he supports Jeff Sessions. There's a lot of support on Capitol Hill for Jeff Sessions, and there is also concerns that the president doesn't seem to realize that there's an independence that needs to happen with the attorney general, with the Justice Department, and the president does not seem to appreciate that. And a number of Republicans, including Ben Sasse of Nebraska, told me earlier Thursday that's an issue. The president, the judicial, the Justice Department should be independent, and the president should realize that as well.
Well, you know, that's the point. It's as though he thinks that the attorney general should be, as he asked Comey to be, loyal to him and not to the people of the United States.
Absolutely. And the question, too, is what will happen with Bob Mueller and the special counsel? And will the president take steps to try to fire Bob Mueller if the investigation goes into an area that he doesn't like? We heard the president tell the New York Times also that Bob Mueller should stay away from looking into the president's family's finances and any financial arrangements. And what we do know is that the finances and the money is a big aspect in that what Mueller is almost certainly going to look at and what congressional investigators also are trying to understand as well. So the president making that pretty blatant warning to Bob Mueller, once again raising the specter that perhaps Bob Mueller's job could be on the line too, and that would prompt major concerns from both parties. If he took
I should say the person is continuing to defend the meeting that Donald Jr. set up with Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort. Now we know three Russians with the intent of coming up with dirt on Hillary Clinton. Where is this going, Manu?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions about exactly what happened in that Trump Tower meeting. And we do now know that both Paul Manafort and Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner, who are all in that meeting, will come and or at least have been asked to come testify before the Senate next week. The Kushner in a classified session before the Senate Intelligence Committee, and both Donald Trump Jr. and Manafort in a public session they've been invited to attend for the Senate Judiciary Committee. And if they don't attend, Senator Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the committee, told me earlier Thursday that they're prepared to subpoena them for their appearances. There are questions about exactly who was in the meeting, exactly what was said in the meeting, whether or not there were any efforts or asks of future President Trump at the time to ease sanctions on Russia. All those questions will most certainly be asked of Donald Trump Jr. and Manafort if they do testify in a public session, and Kushner as well. And of course, we know they're going to be under oath, so they cannot mislead Congress in any way.
Didn't Senator Grassley threaten that if they don't appear voluntarily, he may send a marshal?
He did say that. So he said that he said that if the subpoenas, if they don't comply with the subpoenas, we may have to send a marshal to their house to give them to compel their appearance. He said so that may take some more time, which was a pretty remarkable remark.
Yeah. So how come Jared Kushner is testifying behind closed doors?
You know, it's a great question, and one I'm still trying to get the answer to. We know that Kushner doesn't want to go in public. And we also know that the Senate Intelligence Committee is now in a phase where they're conducting a lot of witness interviews in a classified session. A lot of this investigation is happening outside of the public view, is classified. We're not hearing many details. It's very difficult to even get a sense of who is coming before the committee. So it seems like the committee wants to keep things secretive, and they agreed with Kushner because Kushner probably has no real desire to be under the public scrutiny for the statements and apparent misstatements about his meetings with foreign officials that he did not include on his security clearance forms.
So the New York Times is reporting that at the time Paul Manafort joined Donald Trump's campaign in March of 2016, he was in debt to pro-Russian interests as much as $17 million.
That was a remarkable development in this investigation. You can't overstate the role that Paul Manafort plays in not just what the House and Senate are looking at, but also the special counsel's investigation. Paul Manafort, the campaign chairman, at the time where a lot of these meetings apparently may have taken place, these discussions with Sergey Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, the changes to the platform in the RNC during the Republican National Convention, which some believed was included language more favorable to Russia. Whether or not it has ties to Manafort and his ties to pro-Russian groups in Ukraine, this new development of him, you know, having this $17 million debt will once again raise more questions about his role, which is why his testimony next week, if he does actually appear, will be so significant, because it will be the first time he'll be able to answer all of these questions, including the fact that he appears to be had been $17 million in debt to these pro-Russian interests before joining the Trump campaign.
Do you have real doubts as to whether he will appear?
I just don't know yet. You know, I talked to the Manafort representative yesterday, and he said to me, we got the invitation, but we just cannot comment any further. He's been having discussions and providing documents to the Senate Intelligence Committee. So there seems to be some, and it appeared that he was going to go behind closed doors at some point to the Senate Intelligence Committee. It did not seem like he wanted to do this in public. So I think those negotiations are bound to happen. The question is, will Chuck Grassley, you know, carry out his threat that he wants him to appear in public and is willing to subpoena him for his appearance?
Now, the other thing I'm not clear about, and I wonder if you are, what is the scope of Bob Mueller's investigation?
It's a terrific question, and one in which, you know, we hear a lot about the fact that he wants to interview people who are who have knowledge of whether or not the president in any way tried to interfere with the ongoing FBI investigation into his former national security advisor, Michael Flynn. So that suggests that obstruction of justice is one of the areas in which he will very likely look. After he met with Senate Intelligence Committee leaders, the Senate Intelligence Committee leaders told me they would not look into obstruction of justice. They're leaving the criminal aspect to the special counsel's office. So reading the tea leaves, it suggests that's an area they're looking at. Any collusion that may have existed between Russian officials and Trump officials, and those financial arrangements that the president himself does not want Bob Mueller to look at, that almost certainly will be part of what he is looking at. The question is, how quickly can he go? Will he get cooperation from the White House? Will he also be able to obtain the records he needs and the testimony he may need from Russian officials as well? Those are all major questions we just don't know the answer to.
So the big question for me is, if Bob Mueller goes further than President Trump wants him to go, might he indeed turn to fire Bob Mueller? And if that were to happen, we sort of have President Nixon all over again.
Yeah, and you're hearing concerns from Republicans about that already. They are urging him not to do that. Bob Mueller is someone who is widely respected by both sides of the aisle. His naming as a special counsel did prompt a lot of support. You're hearing people on Capitol say, well, look, every time Republicans are asked about some new controversy, they say, well, Bob Mueller's investigating it. I don't want to talk about it. Well, if Bob Mueller's gone, they can no longer say that. And there are going to be a lot of questions and concerns about the president taking this kind of action. Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, was asked about firing Bob Mueller because he would have to actually carry out that request if the president did actually call for his firing. He has pushed back on that in his sworn testimony before the Senate. So we'll see where this ends up. But the president making no subtle warning in that interview with the New York Times, saying that Bob Mueller, in his view, has conflicts because Mueller was under consideration for the FBI director job before his naming as special counsel.
Now, with regard to Syria, Manu, President Trump announced plans to end the covert CIA program of arming anti-Assad rebels. What does that mean? Because that's a move that Russia had been pushing for.
It was a very significant development. I mean, this CIA program is essentially to train and arm these moderate rebels. It was an effort that was opposed by Russia. The question was, you know, whether or not this in any way came after these meetings and discussions between President Trump and Vladimir Putin during the G20 summit. We do know that they talked about a ceasefire in Syria. Was this part of that? And we also know that there's now the second undisclosed meeting that they just disclosed that the president had during a dinner with during the G20. The president said it was only 15 minutes. We have reports that it was actually an hour long. But the fact that if they did agree to this on the side, it's significant. Republican Lindsey Graham said that, I'm quoting a tweet here, he said, if this is true, it's a big loss for Syrians who have been relentlessly attacked by Assad, our Arab partners, and the U.S. standing in the Middle East. So there is significant concern about that. We don't have all the details yet, but we do know that this is a significant development, maybe something the president did on the side as he tries to strike a better relationship with Russia.
Interesting. You know, Manu, finally, we're at near the end of July, coming up to August, which in Washington, because Congress is away, is usually a quiet month. Is that what you're expecting?
Well, I hope for my own sanity that it is. But we do know that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already warned that they would scrap the first 2 weeks of August to try to deal with some outstanding issues. The question is whether or not they get any of those outstanding issues done at the beginning of August in the Senate. It's unlikely. You mentioned the debt ceiling earlier. That's a very difficult thing that Republicans have struggled with for years. Mitch McConnell does want to try to move on that at the beginning of August. That could create another fight within his own party, depending on how they try to move that piece of legislation. And the Russia investigations in both the House and the Senate will continue even as the members go home for their recess. So it may not be that quiet. And anytime the president, of course, tweets, it's never quiet. So I don't think we can count on a typical sleepy summer as we've been accustomed to for years, Diane.
Manu Raju of CNN, thank you so much for being with us.
Anytime, Diane. So happy to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. For 10 years, Dr. Tom Insel led the National Institute for Mental Health. Now, with a startup in Palo Alto, he's working on the idea that the way we use our smartphones may offer insights into our mental health and become a way to deliver more effective treatments. Dr. Insel, so many people these days are struggling with mental illness. For more than 10 years, you were head of the National Institute of Mental Health. First, tell me why you left. Second, tell me where you are now and what the difference is in what you believe you can achieve.
Well, I served for 13 years at the National Institute of Mental Health. It's part of the NIH. I came in early in the George W. Bush years in 2002 and stayed till almost the end of the Obama administration. And that was a spectacular experience to be able to run a large federal agency and to be on the front lines of the research related to mental illness. At that time, it was really a focus on genetics and imaging and neuroscience and the opportunity to take the revolutions in basic science and apply them to a deeper understanding of schizophrenia and autism and depression and PTSD and a whole range of very serious medical problems. I left for several reasons, part of which was that I think once you've been in a role like that for 10 years, you've probably done most of what you set out to do. Yeah. I came there with a very clear mission of what I wanted to accomplish. And for the most part, that had been accomplished between 2002 and 2014, 2015. But also, increasingly, I became interested in pursuing other kinds of approaches to making a difference. I often tell the story that I was giving a lecture at some point about the spectacular science that we were able to support at NIMH, the work on the genetics and epigenetics and understanding the intricacies of brain chemistry and brain dynamics. And someone in the audience, a parent of a young person with schizophrenia, got up and said, "You don't seem to understand. Our house is on fire, and you're telling us about the chemistry of the paint."
That must have been quite a shocker to you.
It was a shocker, and it was exactly what I needed to hear. I think that it's very easy to be seduced by the power and the really elegance of great science. But the reality is we were facing 44,000 suicides every year, and we hadn't reduced the number. So, indeed, the house was on fire, and we weren't doing enough to put that fire out. And so the question for me a couple of years ago was, is there a different approach? And looking at the revolution in technology and social media and the opportunities that were emerging in Silicon Valley to make a difference by going to where people were instead of expecting everybody to come to the bricks and mortar mental health system. Often we were expecting people to come to the academic centers, which just wasn't happening. Maybe we could have a bigger impact. So I moved to what was then called Google Life Sciences. It's a company that later became Verily, a spinoff of Google, and focused on healthcare and developed a mental health program there. And then ultimately left there a few months ago to start my own company called MindStrong Health, trying to answer the question, can we do better? Can we do something to put out this fire in the short term, not 10 to 20 years from now, but can we use the power of technology and the fact that everyone has a smartphone and smartphones are powerful computers with which to measure behavior and to change behavior? Can we do that soon for people who really need better mental health care?
Well, this is really fascinating. So tell me how the smartphone works in.
You know, almost every one of those people is carrying a smartphone in their pocket. There are 200 million smartphones that are already owned and used every day by people in the United States. And so if you're looking to help people who aren't in care, one of the ways to do that is to go after a technology that's ubiquitous. So we're not talking here about genomic sequencing or neuroimaging or a high-tech kind of solution. We're talking about something that everybody has. And from our point of view, one of the first things that we want to be able to do at a company like MindStrong is to provide better ways of measuring depression, better ways of measuring cognitive decline, better ways of measuring anxiety. We can do that in a clinic. We can do that in the laboratory by having people fill out paper and pencil tests of those things. But we can actually pick up a lot of those kinds of behaviors from behaviors on the phone.
How so?
Passively. So when people become depressed, they tend to go out less. They tend to move less. They develop something called psychomotor retardation. It's a long way of saying they slow down. Depression is about really slowing down in every way. Your voice slows down. The speed at which you type when you're sending a text, that slows down. There's a whole kind of, it's like a cloud coming over your personality in a lot of ways. Some people have described it as falling into a dark hole. As people get better, that changes pretty dramatically. And what we're beginning to understand is that so many people live on their phones, and it's the behavior on their phones that confesses exactly what they're going through with psychosis, depression, mania, a whole range of other disorders, that you can see that in the patterns with which they type, in the sensors that pick up activity and your socialization. So simply comparing the number of texts out to the texts in, emails out versus emails in, you can get a sense of how socially connected people are without even looking at the words or the content. Just the metadata tells you a tremendous amount about somebody's mental state. And now we can begin to understand that, provide that information in a way that hopefully is actionable and allows people to get the kind of care they need.
So, Dr. Ensel, how would you go about testing this dynamic? Would you take in a group of individuals who say or who report feeling depressed or with other kinds of mental distress and subject them to a kind of testing process using cell phones? I really want to understand how you would test this theory.
Well, it's the right question, right? Because this is, at this point, an idea that needs to be tested. And it needs to be tested in very rigorous research studies in which the people who are participating become collaborators. These are people who, in our case, they're people who are being treated for a serious mental illness. And we know that one of the huge problems is that when people do come for treatment, they come very late and they don't stay engaged very long. So they get lost to follow-up until they're in a crisis. And so part of what we're very interested in doing is helping people to be able to manage these illnesses by getting them to opt in. So they join us in this process. They become collaborators. And they agree to have us look at the data that's already being collected by their phone. There's not a lot of additional things you have to do here because most people, as I say, live on their phones. That the numbers are that we, on average, access our phones over 70 times a day, and we do something that involves typing or touching the phone 2,600 times a day. So we're, on average, providing a huge amount of information here. What we're trying to do, to use your term, is to test out the extent to which that information is informative about someone's either remission or relapse, how they're doing in the course of their chronic mental illness. Are we able to get information that is more actionable, and more continuous than the way we've been doing it, which is to say, come in 2 weeks for a 15-minute appointment and let's see how you're doing. Those are 2 weeks in which people often suicide. That's when we're losing people, is in this gap between when they're seen in an emergency room and when they come for follow-up. And that's inexcusable. We don't have to lose people because we're not able to follow up for their care.
Tell me how many people thus far have been involved in this kind of process?
It's small. We're talking about hundreds, not thousands at this point. We have in our company, we have very dense data on a few hundred people. We're now doing many, many thousands. We're just beginning to engage on studies where we're looking. An example is a large study of 5,000 people, actually funded by NIMH in part. Mindstrong has now joined this study, in which people have had a traumatic event. They come to an emergency room because of an assault, because of a car accident, because of some sort of trauma. We know that one in five will develop PTSD in the subsequent 12 months, but we don't know who those one in five will be. We're not able to predict. So we're looking at collecting data continuously on them if they opt in to join us on this study, to try to understand whether there are predictors that we can pick up from their phone behavior that might say, oh, this is somebody who isn't sleeping. This is somebody who's becoming socially isolated. And those are, in fact, good predictors of the high risk for PTSD. And these are people who could benefit from an early intervention rather than waiting until they have the full syndrome, the substance abuse, work loss, relationship changes, all of that.
I wonder about issues of privacy and the extent to which people who become part of this study may be concerned about privacy.
It's a key question. I keep saying that the twin pillars that we have to really rest on here are demonstrating efficacy or value, showing that this actually makes a difference and gives us actionable information, and ensuring trust. And the trust piece is going to be critical to manage. It's not only privacy. I think increasingly, for better or for worse, people are coming to terms with the fact that much of their behavior on the internet is not private. There's not as private as they might have thought. That gives me little comfort. I think we still need to think about how to use this information in a way that empowers people instead of serving some commercial interest. And that's actually not as difficult as it may sound. I think that if it's health information with HIPAA compliance and with all of the highest standards of privacy that we can ensure, we can't be 100% certain that in some future time this won't get hacked. But certainly if we do this in a way that gives information to individuals that they can use in the way they want, it's done with full transparency and giving them full agency, and it comes about because it's something they've asked for, then I feel like we at least may be able to provide some benefit and minimize that particular risk. But we should be very clear about this, that like any technology, it's dual use. It's something that we think can help us on an important public health problem, but there's always the risk of it being misused because it involves deep information about somebody's sometimes very personal data.
Dr. Insel, what about people who are not just depressed but seriously ill with something like schizophrenia? How do you believe the cell phone might be able to be of help there?
I was skeptical. I'm a little skeptical about technology in general, but I was particularly skeptical about using technology like a smartphone for people who are disorganized, have cognitive deficits, are really marginal in their ability to function. They may be homeless. Oddly enough, I was wrong. It turns out that people, even with acute psychosis, still tend to use their phones. They may be searching on their phones. They may be also texting on their phones. One of the things that we've discovered in research done through UCSF, University of California at San Francisco here, with an app called Prime, is that people with psychotic illnesses become very socially isolated. And for them, it's one of the most painful parts of having this illness, is they lose contact with family, with friends. And one of the ways in which the technology has been helpful is it's allowed them to build relationships, often on their terms. They may find face-to-face connections overwhelming, but through texting, through posts, through a form of contact in which they have full control, there's a lot more comfort. And they then feel that they can actually be less isolated, more connected than they would have been without this kind of technology. So who's to say? I mean, it turns out often it's this way with this kind of development, that it's most useful in the places that you were perhaps least suspecting it would be helpful.
But what's the follow-up? One may perceive that a person is in difficulty and suffering, but then what is the follow-up?
Yeah, this is the challenge. You know, it's one thing to do what we're doing now, which is provide much more objective measurements of behavior that are continuous and passive and ubiquitous. And that's spectacular, I think, for psychiatry for the first time. It gives us a deeper picture of someone's mental state and their behavior, their cognition, their emotion. That's helpful to have better measurement, but we need better interventions. And of course, a lot of the interventions we think about in psychiatry are medications, but some are actually psychosocial. So interventions like peer support, psychotherapy, skill building, crisis intervention, all of those could be delivered through the same device we're talking about. You can do psychotherapy by smartphone. Certainly you can provide crisis intervention. And I think where we're seeing the most impact, which is really fascinating, is in the value of peer support, the value of giving people, even with serious mental illness, the ability to connect with others with the same illness. And the value in that is not just that they get help from other people, it's that they can give help to other people. Many people with schizophrenia or severe depression feel useless. They feel like they're not able to do anything for anyone else. For the first time, through this kind of a mechanism, they become part of a community where they have something to share and something to contribute, in part because of the suffering they've been through. That's a profoundly important intervention that we haven't really been able to deliver previously.
You know, as I hear you talking about this, it strikes me that your work might be applicable to brain diseases like Alzheimer's, for example, or even Parkinson's, as the sound of the voice, the rhythm of the speech, the rhythm of the thinking and putting words together may change over time. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. And there's already a lot of work that's been done on voice and speech in Parkinson's. Some of this work is also now being done in the earliest phases of Alzheimer's disease. We've known for a while that one of the first signs of dementia is the way in which our word choice begins to narrow. So the diversity of language begins to shrink. You can see this actually in famous authors who have continued to write through the earliest stages of dementia, like Iris Murdoch. And people have done the text analysis of her novels, and they've shown that as she began to develop mild cognitive impairment and then the early phases of dementia, she continued to write, and her novels continued to get published. But the diversity of her language, the way in which she would introduce new or unique words, began to decline in a very dramatic way. And we can do this now with, you've heard of probably similar kinds of analyses being done with Ronald Reagan's speeches, although those were highly edited. But there are many examples of this that say, hey, by looking at speech and voice and language, written language, we can begin to get some of the early diagnostics for a whole range of degenerative brain disorders. I think this is pretty exciting because up until now, we haven't had a way of getting continuous passive data from a ubiquitous tool like a smartphone. It does really change the game and the kind of information we can get at scale and how early we can begin to detect these changes, because the problem with brain disease is we're almost always getting there very late in the game.
Dr. Insel, I want to thank you so very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Diane.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now from the archives. Summer breaks, even when they're just staycations, can give us the time to read a great novel. A few years back, I hosted a panel discussion on why fiction matters, what reading a good story can do for your mind. Here's Rebecca Mead, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of My Life in Middlemarch.
It's such a fascinating idea, this to try to measure the ways in which a novel might affect a reader. I mean, my book is about George Eliot and her great novel, Middlemarch, and it was
one of my favorites of all time.
Good, 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 as it should be. And it was definitely something that George Eliot thought a great deal about, the ways in which fiction can extend the sympathies of the reader. It's something she wrote explicitly about. She said that she thought art is the nearest thing to life. It's a mode of amplifying experience and extending our contact with our fellow men beyond the bounds of our personal lot. So for her, very explicitly, her novels were about enhancing the sympathy of her readers.
You can listen to that entire segment on dianereem.org. That's our show for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Send us an email at drpodcast@wamu.org. Leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.